Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One New York hotel room and the global economy. One ship full of Libyan oil and one more European bailout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today, the 16th of May. Good to have you with us. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the head of the International Monetary Fund, is looking at 5 to 25 years in jail if he's convicted of the sexual assault charges filed against him this weekend. Bail was denied at a hearing in Manhattan today, and there is no way to gracefully turn this story from the alleged crime to what the markets were thinking. But given Strauss-Kahn's role in the global economy, that's exactly what happened. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Just last week, a Bloomberg survey of international investors found 85% expect Greece to default on its debt. That's a stark indicator of the urgency facing the International Monetary Fund in pushing for a resolution to the ongoing crisis. As the former finance minister of France, Dominique Strauss-Kahn's authority on Europe's debt crisis had been widely respected, and his political clout had moved negotiations toward agreement. Now these talks face new uncertainty.
I don't think it's a do-or-die situation, but I do think it's just a terribly awkward time.
David Andrew Singer is a political science professor at MIT. He says as the world's lender of last resort, the IMF is critical in lining up bailouts.
I think if there is a new leader, whoever that person is going to have to be ready to be in the spotlight from day one and really engaging in high-level discussions with leaders, you know, because issues with the Eurozone in particular are so sort of fragile right now.
At Yale University, Professor Kenneth Rogoff, a former IMF economist, expects the organization to stay the course for now.
It will be able to function, absolutely, because a lot of the decisions really had been taken already. But on the other hand, there's a lot more to come.
European finance ministers signed off on $110 billion in loans to Portugal today, but Rogoff says the endgame in Europe remains a long way off. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The federal government's official count of its debt has reached $14.294 trillion and no longer counting. Treasury Department can't borrow any more money until Congress says it's okay. Washington will still manage to pay its bills for another couple of months, though. Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains how the government is pushing back the day of reckoning.
The Treasury Department got ready for today a little over a week ago. It stopped paying federal money into a fund state and local governments use to float their own bonds at higher interest rates. The federal government has used this move in the past, and it could mean a delay in issuing new state and municipal bonds. But this year, Scott Patterson at the National Association of State Budget Officers says interest rates are so low, states can raise their own money.
Because of the current interest rate environment, there isn't a need for state and local governments to take advantage of this program to any great degree.
Treasury will also stop putting money into two federal employee pension funds. The Urban Institute's Robert Reichauer says the delay won't affect current or future retired government workers.
Because when the crisis is over, the Treasury is required by law to pay all of the interest these funds would have received had these special actions not been taken.
Combined, all the cash flow changes give Treasury a little over $200 billion, so it can pay its bills for another 10 or 11 weeks. But it's not reducing any debts, so budget negotiators are considering cutting federal employee retirement benefits as part of a deal to raise the debt ceiling. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Healthcare economists have been saying forever that if you want to lower healthcare costs, you've got to reward doctors and hospitals for giving better care, not just more care. Now, one of the country's biggest insurers says it's going to do just that. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner reports.
Every year, the insurance company WellPoint pays hospitals about 8% more on average than it did the year before to keep up with healthcare costs. But starting next year, hospitals won't get that raise unless they meet WellPoint's new criteria for quality and safety, things like reductions in surgical errors and banning smoking on hospital grounds.
It really shows that the private insurance industry is waking up to the new reality.
David Cutler is a health economist at Harvard. He says WellPoint's move forecasts a larger trend. Next year, Medicare will start paying higher reimbursements to the hospitals they deem more efficient.
And then you say, look, I have to practice differently. I'd better figure out how to get rid of those readmissions. I'd better figure out how to eliminate those infections. Otherwise, I am going to be out of business.
which he says will make patients safer and reduce extra procedures that cost taxpayers billions of dollars. Critics say WellPoint's plan could punish big urban hospitals. Buzz Cooper teaches medicine at the University of Pennsylvania.
It's poor people in urban neighborhoods whose outcomes are poor. And one can't really adjust for that in the billing data that gets reported to WellPoint.
He says the new quality test could push hospitals to choose better patients, wealthier and healthier. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street this Monday had a tiny case of the blues. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The United States is far and away the biggest seller of arms and military equipment in the world. Along with actual weapons, we also send billions of dollars to our allies in military and economic aid, too. A lot of that to the Middle East. But if you're an American defense contractor, you can't just go out and sell things to Saudi Arabia, say, without permission from the government, our government. And all the chaos in the Middle East has given the Pentagon pause. It's reviewing some deals in that region that have already been made, while contractors are desperate to hang on to one of their best markets. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser has that story.
Defense contractors, large and small, are struggling to adjust to the Pentagon review. Among them, advanced technology systems. Struggling is probably not a good way to describe this company. It's located in a posh office park just outside Washington. The lobby looks like it belongs in a fancy hotel, complete with fountains and comfy chairs. A glass elevator takes me to the ninth floor and the company's executive vice president, Mark Kimmett. He's a retired Army Brigadier General, and he thinks of his business in terms of combat.
No plan survives first contact with the enemy. You can have the best business plans in the world, but events change.
Advanced Technology Systems provides maintenance services for tanks and planes, and the Pentagon pays the company to train the troops of foreign allies. But Advanced Technology Systems was swept up in the larger Pentagon review of Mideast contracts when a contract the company won to train Lebanese troops was given a second look. Now it's up for bid again.
During those months while the government was considering whether it should continue this program, naturally that sort of blew some holes into our business projections.
But Kimmett would never dream of taking his company out of the Mideast. There's just too much money to be made. Prothap Chatterjee tracks Mideast arms sales at the Center for American Progress, a liberal-leaning think tank in Washington.
I mean, right now, $1 in $6 that are spent on arms are spent in the Middle East. And you have to compare that to the fact that only 1 in 12 people in the world live in the Middle East.
Washington gives aid to allies in the region with the understanding that they'll spend some of it on U.S. weapons. Last year, the U.S. gave Mideast countries almost $230 billion in military and economic aid, and the flow of money could increase once the unrest fades. Some contractors are already planning for the aftermath of the violence. Doug Brooks heads the International Stability Operations Association, a trade group that represents security and logistics contractors. Brooks says some contractors see dollar signs in the reconstruction of Libya.
Most of the war is being fought with rockets and artillery, and that does create an enormous amount of damage that needs to be rebuilt. If there's still some fighting going on and things like that, then the costs do go up.
Of course, contractors' profits could just as easily go down if governments in the Mideast decide to spend less on weapons and more on social programs to pacify their restless populations. But there's no sign of that happening on a large scale just yet. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You can check out how much aid we give to countries in the Middle East. Go to marketplace.org. We've got a nifty map there for you. International prosecutors want to get their hands on Muammar Gaddafi. Today, the chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Court in The Hague asked for arrest warrants for Gaddafi and his sons. It's for the killing of civilians and the crackdown on anti-government rebels. Meanwhile, one effort to fund those rebels seems to have ground to a halt, or you might say dragged its anchor. Back in April, the first delivery of oil from rebel-held East Libya was shipped and paid for through a deal with the government of Qatar. Since then, though, sanctions originally aimed at Gaddafi and his government have held up the tanker carrying the oil. So the ship, the Equator, and its shipment are stuck. Emma Farge has been tracking the Equator's journey for Reuters. Good to have you with us.
Thanks.
So this ship was supposed to bring in millions of dollars for the Libyan rebels. It's off the coast of Singapore now, has been for a couple of weeks. What's the holdup?
stuck because there isn't enough clarification on whether it's legal or not. So most companies just don't think it's worth the risk to buy it.
The Libyans get the Qatari contract. They sell this oil. The ship sails off into limbo because the sanction regime is not flexible.
It's not. The problem is that the political will that was there back in February isn't necessarily there anymore. So especially in the United Nations, you have a divided council where you have the European powers who are willing to address the issues of the problems with the sanctions regime, but others who are more reluctant, such as Russia and China.
Now, I'm confused because we are constantly told that sanctions, economic sanctions, will be targeted, they will be smart, and yet here we have, it seems, sanctions that are maybe not all that smart.
Well, the problem is that the sanctions regime was designed before we had a divided Libya. So although AGOCO has been exempted from U.S. sanctions, it
AGOCO, hasn't been... remind us what that is.
AGOCO is originally a subsidiary of the Libyan NOC, the National Oil Company, but now it is split off from them. So the issue of untangling it legally from the NOC is very complex, no matter how targeted the sanctions are.
So what might eventually happen with this ship?
It seems to be stuck off Singapore at the moment. Somebody might buy it. Somebody probably has. But as a test case, diplomats, trade sources are saying it hasn't given them the assurances to do further deals with East Libya.
So the Libyans rebels have made one oil deal, and it may well be their last.
Well, it's looking questionable. If these issues can be ironed out in terms of the sanctions regime, then they certainly might be able to export some more. At the moment, it's still up in the air.
Is there a way to target sanctions so that you can geographically limit them and say, okay, this oil came from eastern Libya and we can tell via chemical analysis, so this is okay, but the western oil is not okay?
Yes, certainly. There's several different types of Libyan crude on the market. So in theory, you could do a test based on the sulfur content of that crude and say it came from this field, which is in rebel hands, or this field, which is in Gaddafi hands. The problem, though, of course, is that the front line is moving all the time. And even now, there's no consensus on who owns what.
You know, it seems like the selling of this oil is fine, and that has already happened. It's the buying of it that's the problem?
Yes, indeed. And if there is some issue with this cargo in terms of the legality of it, this could apply all the way down the supply chain. So it wouldn't just be the original buyer that's taking the risk. It's every subsequent buyer until the oil is actually converted into gasoline or jet fuel or something else.
Emma Farge, a correspondent from Reuters, on the mystery of the Liberian-flagged oil tanker Equator with Libyan oil on it. Emma, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, anybody know how to say austerity budget in Portuguese?
I think that if we don't do what we need to do, we're not going to be part of a strong currency area. I'm very sad to say so, but I think it's our last chance.
But first, we got to do the numbers. Some fresh and, yeah, wouldn't you know it, disappointing manufacturing numbers helped push the Dow. Industrials lower 47 points today, a third of 1%. Blue chips closed at 12,548. A weak tech sector weighed on the NASDAQ. It gave up 46 points, almost 1 2/3%, finished at 2782. The S&P 500 continued its two-week slump. It lopped off 8 points, nearly 2/3%, wrapped up at 1329. Some airline stocks took off today after an analyst upgrade on the prospect of lower fuel costs. JetBlue soared more than 5.5%. American Airlines parent company AMR ascended almost 5% today. Urban Outfitters posted lower quarterly profits that missed estimates. The stock unraveled by 1%. Bond prices rose. The U.S. government hit its debt ceiling. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.14%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Tuesday. President Obama meets with King Abdullah of Jordan at the White House. The U.S. Mint will release the second of 10 America the Beautiful silver coins. This one features Yellowstone Park and can be yours for around $280. And on this day in 1973, televised Senate hearings began for Watergate. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We spent some time on the Gulf Coast last month, checking in a year after the BP oil spill. A lot of the communities down there are, at best, still recovering. But today on our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, we go halfway around the world for a conversation with Nigerian novelist Hilun Habila about another coastline dotted with oil rigs. The Niger Delta is one of the world's biggest wetlands. But beneath those swamps lie thousands of miles of pipelines pumping billions of barrels of oil for export. Over the past 50 years, best guesses are that 500 million gallons of that oil has spilled or leaked out into the water. And it's in that water, narrow river passages amid islands and mangrove trees, that Habila sets his new book, Oil on Water. And it's where his protagonist, Rufus, a black journalist, goes in search of the white wife of an oil executive who's been kidnapped by anti-government rebels. Hilun Habila, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
This is a very, the word that kept coming to me as I was reading it was that this is a very liquid book. Not only does the writing and the storyline flow, but the water is ever present in this narrative.
Yeah, that was my intention, to have the two reporters who are sent in search of the kidnapped white woman to travel inland by boat. Gradually, we begin to see the effect of the oil exploration, the devastation on the land. You see the dead fishes on the water. You see the settlements. You see people bathing in oil. You see people dying. You see corpses. You know, you see the activities also of the rebels and the criminals who are using that chaos to make a living.
Yeah, the title of this book actually is a literal one. There is oil on the water there.
Yeah, oil on water. They don't mix.
You're not from this part of Nigeria, though. You're from the northern part, right?
Yes, I'm from the northern part of Nigeria.
Why then set this book down there?
Because we're all involved. You know, as a Nigerian, you can't escape it. Oil is the biggest single export. That's what the government depends on. So if it affects that part of the country where the oil is explored, it also affects all parts of the country. And there's also the increasing violence that has started to be exported. There was a bomb blast, for instance, on October 1st last year in Abuja, the federal capital, which is in the northern part of the country. So how can one sit down and keep quiet and not say anything when such crime is being committed? For profit, you know, people are dying. People are losing their livelihoods. People are just totally being displaced. So I think as a writer, one just has to say something. One has to write about it.
Are there, this is oversimplistic, I guess, but are there good guys and bad guys in Nigeria and the oil? I mean, you've got the militants who are blowing up the oil installations. You've got the oil companies. You've got the government exploiting the people and not sharing the profits. I mean.
Yeah, I always try to avoid that. Like you said, simplistic, you know, portrayal of people. I believe that people are culpable in one way or another, even the lowest of the peasants who are lured by the easy way of making money through kidnapping. You know, even though they started doing that as a protest against the degradation of their environment, at a certain point, you lose sight of that rightful struggle and you turn into a mere criminal. So there really isn't a good person versus bad person in the book. I'm just trying to show people, ordinary people just living in this place and, you know, fighting each other, interacting with each other, and that's it.
So as hard as it is, though, for Nigeria to live with its oil wealth, as evidenced by the violence and the pollution and the political corruption, can Nigeria live without it?
I think Nigeria can live without it. Some people actually say that it's better if Nigeria is without the oil. Oil has heightened the political tension. It's made politicians so greedy and unaccountable. I think if the oil is taken away, people, you know, would begin to think of other ways of developing the agricultural sector, of manufacturing, doing so many other things that people used to do, actually, before discovery of oil.
Has oil brought any good, though?
Some governments have used the oil money to develop infrastructure, build roads. But when you look at what oil money could have done to the country, could have changed, that's where you feel almost as if what has been achieved is nothing.
The book by Helen Habila is called Oil on Water. He teaches creative writing at George Mason University. Mr. Habila, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And we have an excerpt of Oil on Water on our website. You can check our book blog, marketplace.org/thebigbook. Let's circle back to the European debt crisis for a minute here. Even without Dominic Strauss-Kahn running the International Monetary Fund, there are bailouts to be arranged. European finance ministers met in Brussels today and approved yet another rescue package. This time, it's Portugal, which is going to get more than $100 billion in loans to tide them over. In return, the Portuguese government has promised to raise taxes and make deep cuts in public spending. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been in Lisbon assessing the national mood.
Among its many other misfortunes, Portugal did not win the Eurovision Song Contest at the weekend. Critics dismissed its entry as bland and boring. But the song did set pulses racing at the International Monetary Fund and the European Commission, architects of Portugal's bailout. The lyrics include the line, "Belt tightening is futile." Could this be Portugal's national anti-austerity anthem? There is some resistance to the conditions attached to Portugal's bailout. I'm at a picket outside a garbage collection centre in Lisbon. Striking public sector workers are protesting against the planned cuts in pensions, healthcare and other public spending.
We are defending the service, the public service. We are defending the rights of these workers.
Union organiser Luis Dias, he says even though all the main political parties have endorsed the bailout plan, thousands of government workers will carry on staging one-day strikes in protest.
Because we can't accept these measures because they are not good for anyone. So, of course, we'll still fight.
And joining him on this picket line, offering some moral support, is an Irish socialist member of the European Parliament, Paul Murphy.
I think it's vital now that Irish workers, Portuguese workers, Greek workers, Spanish workers, they're all involved in the same struggle against the IMF, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, which essentially, in all these different countries, in slightly different ways, is about making workers pay for the price of the economic crisis that was caused by bankers and speculators.
But the Portuguese workers have not taken to the streets with anything like the same fiery opposition to austerity as the Greeks. And the key to this somewhat muted reaction may lie in Portugal's melancholic folk music. It's called fado.
Fado means fate, and accepting fate is probably an important thing in our culture.
Marketing consultant and blogger Luis Jogues says Portugal's long and tortuous history, from empire to economic decline, has prepared the people for hardship.
I think that we have seen it all. We were one of the richest countries in the world, and we were one of the poorer countries in the world. So what more can happened to us in economic terms.
And anyway, says former finance minister António Nogueira Leite, Portugal has little choice. It must accept the terms of the bailout and get its public finances in order if it wants to stay in the eurozone.
I mean, I think that if we don't do what we need to do, we're not going to be part of a strong currency area. I'm very sad to say so. It's still up to us, but I think it's our last chance.
The Portuguese remain enthusiastic about membership of the EU and the eurozone, but the crisis has left a bitter taste. A threat by Finland to block the bailout has infuriated many here and prompted this videoed riposte.
What do the Finns need to know about Portugal?
This catalogue of the highs and lows of Portuguese history climaxes with a curious list. The items that Portugal donated to Finland when that country was on its knees after war with Russia in 1940.
19,902 crates of sardines, 956 crates of onions,
a crate of rubber hot water bottles, and a crate of skis.
That was Portugal's bailout of Finland 70 years ago. In Lisbon, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the broadcast, the controversy in Germany over some of those recent EU bailouts. They're the ones paying the bills, you know.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which the history major in me comes out, we're just going to roll this tape and I'm going to let you figure it out.
Unfortunately, Congress consistently brings the government to the edge of default before facing its responsibility. This brinkmanship threatens the holders of government bonds and those who rely on Social Security and veteran benefits. Interest rates would skyrocket. Instability would occur in financial markets, and the federal deficit would soar.
Ronald Reagan, 1987, a year in which Congress and the president agreed to raise the debt limit four separate times. That's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back 47 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ lost 46 points. That works out to almost 1 2/3% on that particular index. The S&P 500 gave back 8 points, not quite 2/3 of 1%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Back here next time, 40 years ago this year, Henry Kissinger went to China for President Nixon. His plane lands. They open the door.
The Chinese did not have a stairway for a 707, and they had to build one because they didn't want to buy one and admit that they didn't have one.
My, how things change. Henry Kissinger on China on the broadcast tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.